This is Kim.
This is Cal.
And you're listening to Shiny Things. This is a story of hope and strength. A story about a mother and daughter that went through hell together and came out the other side. The Stauffer family was the epitome of the perfect suburban family. They were almost like those 1950s families that you saw on TV that were just perfect. They were the kind of people that loved everyone and everyone loved them. So when word spread of the kidnapping of Mary and her daughter Elizabeth, it rocked this Midwest town. So I think I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So in order for me to tell this story properly, I need to start way back in the beginning when Mary and her husband Irving first met. It was 1960 in Minnesota. Mary was a 16-year-old high school student, and Irving was a 19-year-old math major on break from college. So both of them had very strong values and a very deep faith in their Lord. So it wasn't really a big surprise when they were introduced while volunteering at their Baptist church that they had an immediate connection that grew stronger over time. A couple of years passed and Mary graduated from high school and followed in Irving's footsteps and enrolled in Bethel University, majoring in math and minoring in music. Some may say she was a bit of an overachiever, but God bless the people with lots of brains. So by 1965, they had both graduated. Mary applied her degree to her passion and became a high school math teacher and thoroughly enjoyed being part of the learning process. She loved having the opportunity to help her students excel. Irving saw his future a lot different than he did when he first started college and realized his faith was his future and enrolled in seminary school to become a pastor. So one of the requirements of seminary school was that he had to fulfill a missionary trip prior to graduating. So 3 years later, they left for a three-month stay in the Philippines before returning back to the States. Now, sometime between college and this trip to the Philippines, they were married, but I'm not exactly sure when. But in 1972, they welcomed their first child into the world and named her Elizabeth, Beth for short. So when Beth was three, they decided to go on another missionary trip to the Philippines. And 2 years after arriving in the Philippines, Mary became pregnant with their second child, Stephen. So their life was good. They were like going along, singing a happy tune, minding their business, doing the right thing for others. And they were really making a difference in the world. They were experiencing new customs, new cultures, and they had the opportunity to do this for their children. So I think that's really cool. They were living a life that most people don't ever have the opportunity to experience, and they couldn't have been happier. The Stauffer family returned to Minnesota in 1978. And since they planned to return to the Philippines in a short year, they found and rented a place for their little family. Well, the year came and went, and it was time again to start the tedious tasks of packing yet again for their four-year stay in the Philippines. Now, anybody that's been on a vacation knows that packing is a pain in the ass. Can you imagine packing for a four-year stay? Plus have two small children? I can't. So, anywho, it was Friday, May 16th, and they were in the final countdown, and there was still so much to be done, including getting the children's hairs cut. So Mary made appointments at the local beauty salon. on Cleveland Avenue, and since it was only 5 minutes away, her plan was to get Stephen's haircut first while Beth was at school, and then drop him off in the car that they had borrowed from the church, a 1972 Ford LTD, for his afternoon school program, and then she would switch kids, pick Beth up, and head back to Carmen's. As if her day wasn't busy enough, Irving's sister Sandra was coming for dinner, basically for a farewell dinner before they left, and Mary still needed to be home in time to make dinner, so time was of the essence. Sandra arrived at the Stauffer home around 6 o'clock. However, Mary and Beth weren't home yet, which was not like Mary. She was one of those type A personalities, you know, highly motivated, detail-oriented. Basically, she was the one in the relationship that kept all the balls in the air. So for her not to be home for dinner, or at least have it started, was extremely out of the ordinary. So more time passed, and they still weren't home, which was giving Irving a very uneasy feeling. But he told himself there had to be a logical explanation. So he ended up calling the salon to basically find out what the hell was going on. Not in so many words, because he was, you know, a God-fearing man. But he was told that Mary and Beth left the salon around 4:30. Now, as you can imagine, Irving was trying to control his panic for his son's sake, but you can understand that he was silently freaking out, not knowing where they were or what happened. He began calling nearby hospitals, which, you know, that's logical, but no one matching their descriptions had been admitted or even seen in the ER. So by this time, Irving was in full panic mode and ended up calling the police. But they didn't seem at all concerned, which was kind of shocking. They seemed like they were involved in a more important thing and basically told Irving she was an adult and would return home soon enough. I'm pretty sure at this point he was thinking to himself, WTF, this is my wife and child. There's nothing more important. So a few hours after Irving placed the call to police, an officer arrived at the home and to follow up and alluded to a scenario of some sort of domestic situation. And it made Irving feel as if they thought that he had something to do with their disappearance, which was absolutely not true. And it wasn't the case. They were wasting precious time, since everyone knows the first few hours of a disappearance is crucial. The officer left after a little bit more conversation, and this left Irving feeling even more helpless and discouraged. So remember, I said Irving felt like he was getting the brush off? Well, he kind of was, because just before he called the police, they received a phone call in regards to a six-year-old boy named Jason Wilkman, who had been abducted in a nearby park. So, unbeknownst to all parties involved, the two cases actually tied together. Little Jason's friend had witnessed a man throw him in the trunk of his car and immediately ran home to tell his mom, who reported the crime to the police, and then they all met up at the park to search. And what investigators found was that they thought to be a license plate to the car that abducted Jason. So they ran the plate number and were able to verify the plate they found was actually off of the car that the church had loaned Mary to drive that day. And just like that, police realized the two cases were somehow connected. The little boy that witnessed Jason being thrown in the trunk of the car was able to work with a sketch artist to come up with a composite drawing of what the abductor looked like and had described to him as being a man with a mustache and a bowl haircut with bangs that wore big, thick glasses. Unfortunately, when they put the sketch in the paper for everyone to see, they also put a picture of Irving next to it. So as you can imagine, eyebrows were raised due to the striking resemblance to Irving. This wasn't good. Now everyone was thinking he was involved, which was taking the heat off the real abductor and wasting precious time. So Irving's innocence was soon verified after he was brought in for questioning and ended up taking a lie detector test, and he passed because he wasn't involved in it. So he was no longer a suspect. Irving's fears were getting the best of him, though. He was losing hope, and that's when he turned to the faith and strength of his Lord. A day or two later, Irving got a call from the FBI working the case, told him an unidentified human female body was found in southern Minnesota, but thankfully it wasn't Mary. What an emotional roller coaster. This was almost too much to bear for him. I can imagine, my God, the toll that must have taken on him. Days later, Irving received a letter in the mail, and even though it wasn't signed, he knew it was from his wife, Mary, because it was her handwriting. And it said that she wasn't missing and that she left because she needed some time and space. Which was very odd because they were all so excited about leaving for their 4-year trip to the Philippines. So then a few days, maybe a week later, a second letter arrived, but was much more abrupt and almost angry, saying that he needed to get rid of the police involvement or he'd never see her again. On June 15th, Irving answered the phone and heard a little voice that he thought was Beth. Seven and a half weeks after the disappearance, letter number 3 came to Mary's parents' house. I have no idea what was in the letter, but that same day, there was a big break in the case. 53 heartbreaking days after Mary and Beth went missing, the sheriff's department received a call from a female that said, "This is Mary Stauffer, the Arden Hills kidnap victim. I'm at 1916 North Hamlin Avenue. I would like someone to come get us." Now, because the police found the license plate off the car Mary was driving, they knew Jason Wilkman's abduction was somehow tied to Mary's disappearance. So they asked her if he was with her, and after some hesitation, Mary sadly replied, "No." Police went to the address Mary provided and brought them to the police station where they were reunited with Irving and Stephen. The little family was together again. However, it was almost surreal. Mary was there but didn't really feel like she was there. She almost felt like she was watching what was unraveling. And you can understand this. I mean, she was probably still in shock. So the manhunt was underway as the two rehashed all the painful details of the last 7.5 weeks. Mary said it was all very normal conversation as they walked to the car in the parking lot after she got Beth's haircut. They were talking about how nice her hair looked and about the trip they were about to leave on. And then out of the blue, a man appeared next to Beth and pointed a gun at her. At this point, Mary thought he was there to either rob them or jack the car. But when she tried to give him the car keys and her cash, he ignored her and forced them both into the car by gunpoint and ordered Mary to drive north. So throughout this drive, Mary kept telling him how she and her family were Christians and it was her job to help people in trouble and or in need, and that it wasn't too late for him and that she'd help him any way she could. But he just told her to shut up and drive. So during the drive, they came to a stop at an intersection when a police car pulled up behind them. And seeing that it was too soon for anyone to really realize they were missing, it was just a coincidence. But it totally freaked this guy out, and he told her if the police officer turned the same way they did, he'd shoot Beth. The officer thankfully went the opposite direction, and the drive continued for what seemed like a lifetime until they reached a remote location where they were ordered out of the car. And he tied their wrists and taped their mouths shut and forced them back into the trunk of the car and took off again. So Beth was little, so she was able to free her wrists, a couple of the ropes, and was in the process of undoing her mother's when the car stopped and the trunk flew open, and that's when the abductor saw what was going on, and he got really pissed off. And again, because they were making too much noise, he threw a tire on top of them, which made it extremely difficult to move, let alone breathe. They had no idea where they were, and since their abductor was nowhere in sight when he actually left the trunk open. And they tried to look around for some possible landmarks or something familiar, but with the tire on top of them and their wrists tied behind their backs, it was basically impossible. And that's when little Jason Wilkman approached the vehicle to see what was going on, because he had seen some people, which he couldn't believe were actually in a trunk. And he thought his eyes were playing tricks on him. So he basically went up to see what was going on. And out of nowhere, he was shoved into the trunk with Mary and Beth. And the trunk was slammed shut. And once again, the car took off like a rocket. And as I'm sure you can understand, Jason was hysterically crying and told Mary and Beth that he needed to get home because he was going to his grandma's that day. Poor thing. But that didn't happen because the car came to another stop and Jason was removed from the trunk along with a crowbar. The abductor and Jason were gone for such a long time, and at this point, all Beth and Mary knew or could do was to wait in that hot trunk, not knowing what was happening or what was going to happen next. So what happened next was the car started up again, but no Jason. They had no idea what happened to Jason, but had a bad feeling. Eventually, they were taken out of the trunk of the car and forced into a panel van where they were tied up and blindfolded. And when they reached their final location, they were brought into a house and chained in a small, narrow closet with a couple of pillows and a rug, a light bulb with one of those pull switches on it, and some plastic bags on a shelf. And that's it. That's all that was in that closet. So the next morning, Mary was taken out of the closet and brought to the living room where she was tied to a couch on the floor, and the man began performing what looked like an interview of her because he had a camcorder and he was like asking her all kinds of random questions for hours. And it didn't really make any sense until he started asking questions about Ramsey High School and the student that created a formula for an algebra problem. And that's when it clicked. She knew this man. He had been a student when she taught math at Ramsey High School 15 years ago. Mary remembered him being, and he was a well-rounded student, very smart and athletic, never caused any trouble, basically a good kid. Looks are deceiving, huh? His name was Ming Sensu. Ming began to get visibly annoyed and aggravated when he told her she was the only teacher to ever give him a B, and that B caused his academic average to drop, which made him ineligible to receive a college scholarship to any Ivy League college. So he went on to say his father passed away, leaving his family cash poor, so college was completely out of the question. It wasn't an option. And he ended up getting drafted and became a POW. Basically, it boiled down to him blaming her for his shit show of a life. So Ming went on to say that he tried to abduct her many times. He'd actually broken into the house he thought was Mary's, but it turned out to be Irving Sr.'s house. So when he realized he had screwed up, he tied Irving Sr. and his wife up at gunpoint and told them that if they ever went to the police or mentioned it to anyone, he'd come back and kill them. So here's a sidebar. A few years after this happened, they finally summoned up the courage to tell Irving Jr. and Mary what happened. And now Ming was admitting to being that intruder. So he'd been stalking her for the last 15 years. But since the stalkers moved so often with the missionary, it became almost impossible to track her. But then in 1979, Ming found out through a newspaper article that Mary was back in town and began stalking their home again. So he told Mary that he used to sit in the woods behind their apartment for hours, watching and learning their routine. He even went so far as to try to get through the patio doors with a blowtorch. And if you think that's creepy, listen to this. So there was a storage unit underneath their apartment. I'm assuming it was like a two-family house that, you know, had like no basement in it, but it had a storage area. And Ming had gained access and drilled up through the floorboards underneath Mary and Irving's bed. So 2 days prior to them being abducted, Mary was woke in the middle of the night by the sound of glass breaking, and when she went to check it out, she saw a man standing outside the broken window looking at her. So she ran back to tell Irving and get him, but by the time they returned, he was gone. And, shocker, that was Ming too. So Mary apologized repeatedly for giving this asshole a B, but he wasn't having any of it. He wanted his revenge. Ming said, "I don't want your scars to be physical. I want them to be emotional. I want you to feel dirty, defaced, and degraded." He sexually assaulted her for 6 hours and recorded the entire thing. Mary said she coped by telling herself it was happening to her physical body and not her soul, and that he couldn't get to her soul if she didn't allow him. So all Mary could think of was, "God, don't let him do this to Beth." It's one thing to rape a married woman, but it's a whole nother story when it's a child. He never did rape Beth, but he did threaten Mary, saying that if she wasn't loving and affectionate towards him, he would. So Mary told him that she refused to show him any kind of affection because she was in love and married to her husband, in which she took vows to be faithful to him. So after he heard this, he mulled it over in his brain and he said, basically, have you ever watched somebody suffocate and put a clear plastic bag over Beth's head? He said, it'll only take 4 or 5 minutes, and once she uses up all the oxygen in the bag, she'll be dead. The next threat was that if Mary didn't comply, he'd not only kill Beth, but he'd kill her husband and son. So at this point, Mary decided to throw him a crumb, so to speak, and kissed him on the cheek. But that was definitely not what Ming had in mind and said just that. So Mary ended up relented and kissed him on the mouth, which must have satisfied him enough because he removed the bag from Beth's head. As the days went on, Ming began to let his guard down a little and allowed them to shower and prepare meals as long as they were chained together. And he's delusional. He started acting like Beth's father, like a father figure, and even gave her a little nickname of Bethy. So a few months after being abducted, Ming asked Mary if she wanted to go on a vacation. And of course, after being stuck in that little closet, they were willing to go basically anywhere. So she basically jumped at the chance and she saw this as an opportunity to escape. So they set off on the road in a Winnebago and arrived in Madison 3 hours later. There they went into the public to a mall for the first time since they were abducted. And since that was the case, Ming decided he was going to buy them new clothes and reminded them yet again to pretend that they were a happy family or else. So at this point, Mary's head was spinning, trying to think of a way to get someone's attention or ask for help without Ming noticing. And that's when she realized she still had the traveler's checks that she had got for the trip in her purse. So she ended up telling Ming that they could use them checks to purchase the clothes. And by doing this, Mary was praying that somehow it'd ping onto her account, and if they were tracking it, they would find her location. But sadly, nothing happened because even though it pinged, it apparently wasn't ever reported to the FBI. So no one came to their rescue. And so they ended up driving another 3 hours until Ming parked the Winnebago in a parking lot, and he basically just left them there. Like, what the hell? He was obviously letting his guard down. So naturally, they were peeking out the window when they saw a group of teenagers walking by. So Mary yelled to get their attention and said that they had been kidnapped and begged for their help. But their response was not what she was expecting. They basically laughed at her and told her to stop making up stories and walked away. So during their little vacation, so to speak, they continued to travel from city to city while Mary continued to try and find ways to escape or alert someone. But basically every attempt failed. And during this little vacation of sorts, Mary and Beth would take the Bible that was left in the room and prayed every single day. And that's when little 8-year-old Beth, who was basically wise beyond her years, told her mom that they needed to pretend to like Ming because in the Bible, it says to be kind to your enemies. So that's what they started to do in order to survive. Well, Ming fell for it, and on Father's Day, he allowed Beth to call her dad And after the call, he took them out to Hardee's to eat and watch fireworks. Just like a little happy family. Mary said it was so hard because there were so many sheriff's deputies around and she wanted to scream for their help. But once again, with Ming so close, she couldn't chance Beth being hurt or worse yet. Ming would follow through on his threats and kill her. So 3 days later, they had gone back to the little small closet again and were chained up. But were told that they were going to move to a camper shortly because they weren't going to be living in the house any longer. And that's when Mary and Beth were like scared beyond belief because they thought if they moved again, no one would ever find them, which made them even more determined to escape this hell. So Ming chained them in the closet and went off to work. And for some reason, he didn't bring Beth with him. And that almost never happened. Usually, when he went to work, he'd separate the two and he would put Beth in a box in the back of the panel van and lock it. So she's in the box while he's, you know, basically going about his work day and she's in the box and Mary's in the closet. So later, Ming would realize that this was a fatal mistake because Mary realized the cable that they were chained to was looped through the hinge of the door and was much longer than it was when they first got chained up, since Ming had changed out the cable with longer ones so they were able to move about and go to the bathroom and move around the closet and on their own and still be chained. It was at that very moment that Mary realized, or rather remembered, her father removing hinges with a hammer. But she didn't have a hammer, but she sure shit was going to try to get those hinges released from the door frame. And they were no longer attached only to each other. Once she removed that door from the hinges, it popped right off. They ran upstairs and called the sheriff's department and were placed on hold 2 times. And as you can imagine, they were so scared Ming would return at any moment, find out what they were up to, and he'd kill them both. But finally, the sheriff's office came on the phone, and Mary was able to tell them the address on a piece of paper she'd found in the closet on the floor. So they waited outside behind the car out of sight just in case Ming did come back for some reason, terrified the entire time. Basically, scared shitless that at any moment he was going to come back and kill them. So they waited for what seemed like forever until they heard sirens in the background, and that's when they knew the police were coming to save them. The FBI had gone to the electronics store that Ming worked at and brought Beth there many times, which he actually owned, and they arrested him. The entire time he claimed he had no idea what he was being arrested for, but when he got to the police station and saw Mary, he screamed at her, "Why did you leave me?" So after hearing Mary's story and fact-checking Ming's life, the FBI found that everything Ming told Mary was a lie. Ming had graduated top 1 in his high school and could have easily gotten a scholarship to any Ivy League college, but he chose to attend the University of Minnesota, where he was voted most likely to succeed by his peers. It was also uncovered that he had never joined the military and he had started his own business and that it was worth millions. So Ming was known to write fantasies about women he obsessed over, and on that list was Mary. Former classmates had said that he'd always been obsessed with Mary since he started taking her class. So I'm not sure how they knew this, if he made it public or they just picked up on his vibes, but that's creepy. They also were able to uncover some bizarre behaviors Ming had even before meeting Mary. For instance, when he was 14, he was given a probation for setting fire to a building on his paper route and had absolutely no explanation why he did it. So he was given a psychiatric exam after he cut open his mother's pajama pants in the middle of the night while she was sleeping to look at her with a flashlight, and said he had pressures in his head, or maybe he meant voices in his head, that made him do it. With that being said, it's pretty obvious he wasn't a stable child. He was placed in a psychiatric treatment center for several weeks, and then after his stay at the center, he returned to school, and that's when he saw Mary and became fixated on her. To family and friends, Mary and Beth seem unaffected. They said their faith was what pulled them through these very dark days and nights. They also believe Ming didn't ruin their lives. He ruined his. Ming was apprehended, and during questioning, he basically spilled his guts. He had heard Irving and Mary were making plans to leave the country again, so he decided it was time to make his move. The house he was living in was not only his, it was also his younger brother Ron's. And Ron, get this, Ron lived in the basement the entire time of this abduction. So while they were being held captive, Ron was downstairs. But Ron said he never really heard anything out of the ordinary. He thought maybe Ming had a girlfriend, but he was rarely there since he was in college. And since they didn't get along and they barely spoke, Ron had absolutely no idea what was going on. Ming went on to say he was obsessed with Mary because she reminded him of his mother, that she was warm and caring, and they were both math teachers. But this is why I think this is so weird. It's because his mom was still alive. So fast forward to more craziness. While awaiting trial, Ming had a cellmate named Richard Green. When Richard was released a few days later, he received $1,000. And police found out about $1,000 and began to monitor Ming's finances. And that's when he found out that he had been the one to transfer the $1,000 into Richard's account at the jail. So anyway, Richard was brought in for questioning, and he said that Ming had offered him $51,000 to kill Mary and Beth so they couldn't testify against him, and therefore they'd have no reason to hold him. But thankfully this didn't happen. But it does make me wonder, if the police weren't on to Ming, would Richard actually have killed them? I guess we'll never know. So Ming went to great lengths to avoid prison time. He also tried to escape using aluminum foil from a Kit Kat bar to disable alarms in the jail. I'm not sure if he was like some kind of MacGyver, but thankfully an officer found him before he escaped. The trial began and was extremely hard for Mary, who had to sit through the footage of her sexual assault and explain what he was saying during the time of the assault. And if that wasn't hard enough, she had to take the stand in front of Ming. So as she began to walk to the stand, she heard like this rumbling, tussling behind her. And when she turned around, she saw that Ming had jumped out of his chair and had tried to lunge at Mary. But thankfully, the prosecutor, with his spidey senses, were on high alert and took Ming to the ground. So, anywho, 10 days later, Ming was found guilty of kidnapping Mary and Beth, but wasn't charged yet for the murder of Jason because he refused to give up any information as to the location of Jason's body. But finally, Ming proposed a deal that if he wasn't charged with first-degree murder, of Jason, he'd tell them where he was, which they agreed upon. And when they went to the location that Ming had provided, they found Jason dead with blunt force trauma to the head. The day came for Mary to take the stand in Jason's murder trial. And once again, Ming freaked out, charging at Mary, and put a knife to her throat. So where the hell did he get a knife if he's being held in jail? I have no idea. But he was threatening everybody to stay back or he'd kill her. But once again, Ming was taken down, but not before cutting Mary across the chin to the corner of her mouth so badly that she needed 62 stitches. So Ming was found guilty of the kidnapping and the murder of Jason and was sentenced to 40 years on top of his 30 for kidnapping Beth and Mary. So they never really said anything about what kind of time he got for raping her. But honestly, I don't know. I mean, was that added into the 30 years for the kidnapping? I don't know. In 2010, he was eligible for parole. And if released, he'd be put on the sex offender registry, but that just wasn't enough for Mary and Beth, or the memory of little Jason, for that matter. The psychologist working with Ming deemed him a threat to the community, saying he's a tormented man because he's delusional. His life is psychological hell. Mary had gone to the parole hearing, but all she could hear was what he had told her during the abduction, ringing in her ears. He had said, "Don't think that even if I get caught and put in prison, I'll forget about you. Because when I do get out, I'll find you and you'll be dead. And then I'll go after your kids." Thankfully, he was denied parole. Mary and Beth say they've recovered from their terrifying ordeal by having a wonderful life.
By having a wonderful life afterwards. In some ways, it's the best way to not let him win.
Find us at patreon.com/shinythingspodcast. Follow us on Instagram at shinythingspodcast. Find us on our Facebook group page called Shiny Things Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at shinythingspod1. You can email us at shinythingspodcast@gmail.com. Don't be shy. Use any of our social media to send us show ideas, some love, or share additional details we may have missed. Remember to like us and give us 5 stars on your favorite podcasting platform. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This show is a part of the Quite the Thing Media Podcast Network.